'Twas 3 days before Christmas in 1982. At Santa's North Pole workshop, there was lots of work to do. A million toys they had to make for lots of little tykes. When all at once the elves cried out, "We're going out on strike!" Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, and little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike.
It's a really intense experience to see how little of a shit capitalists care at all about workers. Like, literally just look at them deciding, farm workers, you can die. Grocery store clerks who are feeding us, you can die. DoorDash, whatever, delivery people, y'all can die.
The Santa Claus has more than 400 workers. Polar Express has nearly 1,000. It takes so many human beings, so much human labor to make these films.
It's really working satirically. It feels like, you know, Borat works in the world of Trump.
And Scrooge, oh, he was a tight, tight-fisted man. Squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covered as old sinner. There's a lot of words to say one thing. Ebenezer Scrooge was a banker.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, and have we got a show for you today. On the Belabored Podcast, Sarah Jaffe and Michelle Chen gather three of their favorite thinkers on labor and unions, Jane McAlevey, Bill Fletcher Jr., and Rebecca Dixon, for a no-holds-barred look back on 2020, a truly tumultuous year for workers. Then, on Your Rights at Work, Ed Smith and I chat with Kathy Newman about the workers who make your favorite holiday movies possible. We stay with the workers behind the movies as On Writing, a screenwriting podcast from the Writers Guild of America East, talks with Sacha Baron Cohen, Anthony Hines, and Peter Bainum, the co-writers of Borat's subsequent movie film, about why they decided to revisit the iconic character, how intense it was to film that now infamous Rudy Giuliani scene, and the reality of filming in very dangerous situations. And since this is Christmas week, we've got a special treat for you. The first part of A Red Carol from the San Francisco Mime Troupe. This brand new radio drama returns to the working class roots of Charles Dickens' classic holiday story of greed and redemption, along with a few labor songs. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on today's Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices with a selection of highlights from the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Here's the show.
So Santa called his lawyers in, and soon the deal was done. The elves ran up and hugged him, and everyone had won. They all worked double shifts until they'd made a million toys, and Santa made deliveries to happy girls and boys. Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, and little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. The year the elves went out on strike.
Listening to Dissent Magazine's Belabored Podcast, hosted by Sarah Jaffe and Michelle Chen.
Hi, welcome to Belabored Live, End of the Worst Year Ever edition, episode 212 of Belabored, and we thought it would be good to wrap up this awful year with three of our favorite people to talk about the year. Our wonderful panel for this evening that I'm very excited to introduce to you is Rebecca Dixon, who is the Executive Director of the National Employment Law Project, where she was previously a policy analyst, senior staff attorney, and deputy program director. Her areas of expertise include occupational segregation, unemployment insurance, and workplace equity. And at NELP, she aims to contribute to a strong workers' movement that dismantles structural racism, eliminates economic inequality, and builds worker power. Bill Fletcher Jr. has been active in workplace and community struggles, worked for quite a few labor unions, in addition to serving as a senior staff person in the National AFL-CIO. He is the former president of TransAfrica Forum, in the leadership of several other projects, the co-author of The Indispensable Ally and of Solidarity Divided, and the author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. And Jane McAlevey is the nation's strikes correspondent, an organizer, author, and scholar, and a senior policy fellow at the University of California at Berkeley's Labor Center. Her most recent book, A Collective Bargain, Unions, Organizing, and the Fight for Democracy, is out now from HarperCollins, and she is also the author of the excellent No Shortcuts and Raising Expectations and Raising Hell.
I think that this year really just exposed the most grotesque underbelly that is the capitalist system as we understand it in the United States. When I am on the phone with trade union leaders from, you know, United Food and Commercial Workers who tell me that they're going to members' funerals, it's a really intense experience to see how little of a shit capitalists care at all about workers. So I think the thing that's really intense is that on the one hand, it's become really explicit this year. Like literally just look at them deciding farm workers, you can die. Grocery store clerks who are feeding us, you can die. DoorDash, whatever, delivery people, y'all can die in service of our needs. And then in the same breath, basically say, we don't have to pay you. You don't need personal protective equipment. Just nothing. I feel like there's a very interesting line we're going to walk heading into the post-pandemic moment, which is, on the one hand, I think a lot of workers, even more workers than normal, are freaked out, pissed off, angry, want change, want it now. And that's a little bit tempered by something as an organizer that I'm mindful of, which is they're also exhausted, mentally spent, emotionally trashed. And so the idea that we're going to have a quick militant revolution coming off the pandemic, I think has to be a little bit tempered by the reality that people need a nap. They need to have funerals and weddings and cry. And it's really intense out there. But I do feel hopeful that in the aftermath of people taking a bit of a break when they're allowed to do so, I think there's going to be a hell of a lot of retribution to pay. That's my goal in life, is that some shareholders and a whole lot more people are going to pay. And the far right at the top of the decision-making ladder are enablers of like a certain set of politics. But the Mitch McConnells and the Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezoses of this world, I think that this pandemic, again, I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but I think that we're going to see an opening to a level of strike activity and worker organizing that I am hopeful is going to be bigger than it has been in my lifetime. And I think that it's incumbent, going back to a comment Bill made early on, I think it's really incumbent upon every one of us to force the trade union movement to rise to the occasion of the moment that we're in, because they are not there right now. They are not there yet. And the question is, how much heat from the base is going to come to force a different national politics in a set of trade unions that know effing better about the quietness with which they have approached this moment. Yes, it's a grotesque year, and there's going to be a hell of a lot to pay for it, I think, if we do our work right in a good way.
Anyone else want to chime in on sharpening those pitchforks?
As usual, I agree with Jane. But I would say that at the level of strategy, there's a few things that we got to be thinking about. One is understanding that there is not a Trumpist movement out there. There's a right-wing populist movement out there. As my wife said very well, Trump is the rattler on the tail of the rattlesnake. He is not the rattlesnake. The rattlesnake has been going through the body politic for a while and has been injecting poison into the system. Trump is the rattler. He's the noise. There is a deep movement and a long history to right-wing populism in the United States. And we're going to have to be figuring out how to take this up, because our enemy, just as with when people had to go up against the Nazis, is not simply the people at the top. There is an army of people, some of whom might in other circumstances be very nice people, who are demonic. And they want to annihilate us. And I don't mean that euphemistically. They wish to annihilate us. So part of the progressive movement really has to be, going back to something Jane was raising, we have to do a very intense internal education, but we also have to be thinking about how do we fight for power, and power on multiple levels. I think everything from a transformation in the way we think about workplace power, but also electoral power, and not just about electoral turnout, but we have to be asking ourselves some questions. How do we take over Texas? How do we take over Florida? Not how do we jump on a particular person's campaign, but how do we build a progressive pro-working class force that actually can begin to win power? Because if we're not talking about fighting for power, we might as well just pass out the joints and call it a day, because none of it will make any difference.
Rebecca, did you want to perhaps adding from a perspective of someone who works with workplace protections and benefits, you can sort of talk about the how inequality has been affected, or those underlying inequalities have been affected by the pandemic?
Sure. One of the biggest things we've seen is an awareness that the workers who are most likely to be deemed essential but treated as disposable are workers of color. But that's not new. That's been forever. And those workers have always had the highest injury rates, the highest fatality rates. And even up into the 20th century, dirty and dangerous jobs were called Negro work. That was just what it was. And so if you just pull that thread through to now, that's who we're seeing who are working in food processing and supermarkets and warehouses and nursing homes, and who are getting sick and dying when it's preventable. And so I think understanding what's at stake, and now that the light is on for this, like, what do we do about it? It's a crisis, but also there's an opportunity. And I agree with the panelists, without power, we can be aware of these disparities and aware of all of this, but we can't change it if we don't have power to make the change happen.
So we're going to start our Q&A round. Does anyone have a strategy for counteracting the influence of right-wing talk radio, especially on working class white voters?
I have been in so many discussions in the unions where people say, we have to do something to counter Fox News. We need our own station. And the reality is, we're not going to have one. The oppressed never have more resources than the oppressor. Jesus did not have more resources than the Romans. Let's just be real. So once you realize that, then you realize that you have to have a different kind of approach that is not going head to head with the other side in the same way. We're not going to be able to get the resources to get an anti-Fox. There will be media outlets that you can access from time to time, whether it's MSNBC, Al Jazeera, whoever, but it's not going to be head to head. So we've got to be thinking very creatively about how to move our messages. And that includes a much more strategic use of social media, using programs such as yours here. I think that we have to try as best we can to develop echo chambers around the country, progressive echo chambers, which the right wing is very good at developing echo chambers. We're not so good. We do like an occasional op-ed and applaud, but we don't really develop strategically how to move echo chambers. So we have to have a communication strategy that's operating on multiple levels in order to beat back the other side.
I just want to put my regular plug in for replacing pollsters with organizers in the national labor movement, but I'm serious about that. There really has been a marked drop in the number of actual organizers in the trade union movement. And I think that their replacement with highly compensated messaging firms has been an abject failure. quite frankly. And I think the one thing that's always interesting to me is when I say things like, let's go back on the doors, let's go back to basic grassroots organizing in strategic labor markets, in strategic sectors, right? We have to be, like, make some cuts somewhere in there. There's just this, there's this myth, which is that organizing takes a long time. And I don't buy it from my life experience. I think that focused strategic resources in strategic sectors, in strategic labor markets, and a return to a re-embrace of like people going on the doors in huge numbers when the pandemic ends is really vital to puncture through the kind of media war that I agree with Bill. We're never going to match them, right? So, and there is nothing quite like going on the doors, but for what purpose, right? We don't just go on the doors to be like, hey, members, how you doing? Hey, workers, how's life? Like, that's not what I mean. I mean, like, aggressively running campaigns, including strikes, and framing the need for urgent conversations on the doors and in the break rooms, on the shop floor, and on the doors in a way that's really intense. And a conversation can immediately puncture sort of the Fox News, social media in a way like nothing I've ever experienced. And if we turn up the volume in a very serious way, which we've been turning down the volume on organizing my entire lifetime, if we actually turned it up in a real way, you would see how quickly whole labor markets can change. I've been involved in a number of whole labor market campaigns over the course of 2 to 3 years, period. Like, everything can change from who becomes a city council, how many workers get unionized, how much housing is saved, how much gentrification is beat, right down the line. So organizing doesn't have to take a long time. It requires resources and discipline and massive training. And there's an army of workers out there who are ready to do the work if we would just enable them.
So thank you to everyone for this wonderful discussion. And I'm really glad that despite our socially distanced circumstances right now, we were able to come together and yeah, have this exchange. Once again, thank you to everyone. Thank you to our panelists for the great discussion. Thank you to all of our attendees, our audience members. And if you enjoyed this event, please support our work by going to our Patreon and chipping in so that we can continue to do these events and put out this content for free for everyone to learn from. So thanks again, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. We're at your throats. This life is hard. So hard,
I must go. Hate when the fact cannot. We can't. You've been listening to Dissent Magazine's Belabored Podcast. For the entire archive of past episodes, visit dissentmagazine.org. Join us online using hashtag belabored.
Oh, confronting a boss is frightful, and Lord knows they can be spiteful. Labor history does advise, organize, organize, organize. When the workers stand strong as one, it's amazing the things they can do. So much work left to do, my friend, but strikes, they are on the uptrend. So if you want better working conditions, higher pay, dignity, or a pension, together you'll win the prize. Organize, organize, organize.
All right, Chris Garlock here with Ed Smith. This is Your Rights at Work. Hey, we have got a terrific show today here on Your Rights at Work. We'll be joined by Kathy Newman. We had her on last year. She's going to be talking some more interesting ideas she's got about how Christmas and class behind the scenes in holiday movies. We're very pleased to welcome back. I'd forgotten, actually, Kathy, that we had you on the show last year, and this is Kathy Newman. So welcome back, Kathy.
Thank you so much.
So you were talking last year about working class Christmas, and then you had a piece that you published on the Working Class Perspectives blog this week, Christmas and Class Behind the Scenes. I have to tell you, Kathy, I watch a lot of Netflix. I'll just be honest. I watch a lot of Netflix, like probably more than I should. And I can't even blame the pandemic because I watch a lot of people. But I thought I knew everything on there, and you found something that I had no idea. I've been watching it all week now, thanks to you. Tell folks what you found.
Something popped up in my feed. The algorithm sent me the Christmas movies that made us, and it's a series of behind-the-scenes narratives, really well told, really exciting, funny, high production values that tells the story of how different movies are made. And the original series, The Movies That Made Us, has four films, and two of those are Christmas films. And then the series that was spun off of is called The Toys That Made Us, which also brings in Christmas to some extent because you hear about the toys that were really hot and controversial and that everybody was trying to get at Christmas. So there's a unity to all of these series. I think they spun off into each other. And I absolutely love the work. I think it's fascinating.
So I should have mentioned at the top, you're associate professor of English at Carnegie Mellon, and you specialize in working class themes in different forms of cultural media, which is, of course, why you're interested in this, as are we. And what you point out about this series, and it's really true, is that it really, a lot of times, things about the movies especially will focus on the stars, which, you know, as a film person, I'm interested in also. But this series really looks at the creators, the folks who make films. And sometimes people get annoyed. I run the Labor Film Festival, and I refuse to bring the lights up until the credits are done. Because, you know, a lot of people, they like to leave as soon as the movie is over, which they think is before the credits. And I'm like, no, these are all the folks, literally hundreds and hundreds of people who made the film. It's not just the people you saw on the screen. And that's what this series focuses on. And that's what you were really focused on in your essay. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. My high school sociology teacher said, always watch the credits. She said, someday my kid might be working on that film and I want you to see his name. And so I'd always had that thought from a very kind of young age of the importance of the people who made it. And then especially when digital movies started to become more popular. If you look at the credits of Moana or The Avengers, it is thousands of people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I was just looking at a few movies before this interview. Elf had more than 800 workers. The Santa Claus has more than 400 workers. Polar Express, one of these digital movies, has nearly 1,000 workers.
Wow.
It takes so many human beings, so much human labor to make these films. And they're things that I never thought about before. The greensman. And the greensman is the person who handles all the plants on the set. And the caterers and the drivers. Every star has a driver. Every star has an assistant. So every person on the set has 10 to 20 people around them that either help them with makeup or costumes or getting from here to there. It's such a complicated enterprise. It's almost like the military, I think, in terms of the number of humans that are required to create like a single minute of film. It's so many people.
It's one of the reasons, I think, that when people hear about these huge budgets, and yes, certainly stars are getting big chunks of change, no doubt. But a lot of that money is, I think, what's called below the line. It's for the folks that you're talking about, the greensmen and all the different folks that are making the films. So you got one of the films, I think, in fact, the first film in this particular series that you're referencing is Elf, which I got to admit, not one of my favorite films, although.
How could that not be one of your favorites? He's not a Will Ferrell fan.
Not a huge Will Ferrell fan, although I will say that it's actually one of his better films. But so spin out for us how that's a labor film or where the labor angle is.
Yeah, so Will Ferrell plays a human raised by the elves at the North Pole. And the first time that we see him as a worker is that he's trying to make Etch-a-Sketches, and his production value, his production output is much lower than the other elves. And they're like, hey, get with the program. We need you to work better, faster, harder. They try to use his height as a way to utilize him. There's this amazing scene where he's testing Jack in the boxes and they scare him. It's like such a lovely, whimsical scene, but he's there as a worker. Now, he doesn't get paid, presumably, right? It's this crazy free labor slavery economy there in the North Pole. But then he decides to go find his real father in New York. And the first thing that happens when he's in a Macy's or it's a Gimbel's Santa Land is he's mistaken for somebody who works there. So he's just incorporated again, like he doesn't go down to the human resources department to get a paycheck. He just starts working for free in Santa Land and overnight creates this magical, like he makes these Lego creations and these snowflakes, and his boss
comes in the next day and he's, I don't know who made this magical Wonderland, but I'm really worried I'm going to get fired because it's like too good and they're going to replace me with the person who did this. Every subplot in the movie is about work and is about workers and their relationships with their bosses. So I just love that about Christmas movies.
Kathy Newman, always just a real joy to talk with you. And just I love the way that you really help us to see things that we think we know in a whole different way. And I really appreciate that.
I love the opportunity to talk about it. Thank you so much. And maybe I'll see you next year.
Oh, I look forward to it. Happy holidays.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Rudolph the Union Reindeer pulled the sleigh for old Saint Nick. He signed a union contract. He knew North Pole politics. All of the other reindeer work long hours around the clock. They paid no heed to Rudolph. They worked in non-union shops. Then one year on Christmas Eve, they all came to say, "We will do what you advise. Rudolph, help us organize." Then how the reindeer loved him as they lined up with their sleigh. Now when they work on Christmas, they're all getting premium pay.
Listening to On Writing, a podcast from the Writers Guild of America East. I'm your host, Jerry Cole. In each episode, you'll hear writers working in film, television, and news break down everything from the writing process to pitching, favorite jokes to key scenes, and so much more. Today, I'm joined by Sacha Baron Cohen, Anthony Hines, and Peter Bainham, three of the writers of Borat: Subsequent Movie Film, the surprise sequel to the 2006 film that's now airing on Amazon Prime. In this interview, I talk with Sacha, Ant, and Peter about why they decided to revisit the iconic character, how intense it was to film that now infamous Rudy Giuliani scene, and the reality of filming in very dangerous situations. So, first question, Borat, we brought the character back. Why did we decide to bring the character back right now?
So, can I start with that one?
Yes, please.
This is Sacha, by the way. So we'd assumed that Borat was impossible to shoot now. You know, that was the thing, was it's impossible to do another Borat movie. Some people over the last 14 years had pitched versions where it was completely scripted because we'd assumed that it was impossible to do with real people again and impossible to do with undercover. But we tried this thing on Jimmy Kimmel. We did this short piece and it went well and we had a realization, which was Borat was essentially a more extreme version of Donald Trump. He was 20% more misogynistic. He was 20% more enthusiastic of white supremacists. The only thing probably he was less than Trump was he was less inclined to pay women for sex. So we realized that he was actually a good mechanism to allow Trump supporters to really open up. And so Borat could say, you know, talk about caging Mexican children and say, it's very nice for them. The cages there are better than the Almaty Four Seasons. And then during Jimmy Kimmel's thing, you know, some of the people we interviewed said, yeah, you're right. They're lucky. The kids are lucky to be in the cages. And we realized that that basic concept of bringing a character that was more extreme than the person you were speaking to allowed that person to really open up.
We just finished writing another movie. I remind you, Sacha, and like we spent months on it. And then the next day.
So we went, so this was the day after the Jimmy Kimmel thing. And we're completing another movie that we'd spent a couple of months writing. And we just in the room, we said, you know, that Jimmy Kimmel thing really worked. It's really working satirically. It feels like, you know, Borat works in the world of Trump. Is there a movie with Borat that we can put out before the election to show the danger of Trumpism? Because the absurdity of Trumpism had already been demonstrated by Donald Trump. And we felt this was our form of protest. We didn't think it would necessarily swing any votes, but we felt that we had to do what we could so that on November 4th of 2020, we could look ourselves in the mirror and say, We did what we could. We made it very clear that we were only going to make the movie if we could release it the week before the election. Otherwise, we weren't interested in doing it. Okay, and that's what we did.
When you find yourself embedded in these situations, how safe do you feel?
Well, it varies from, you know, scene to scene. You know, we shot one scene. For those of you out there who've seen the movie, we shot one scene at a gun rights rally in Washington State. And the story is Borat's trying to find his daughter. And we knew that it was going to be dangerous. We knew that there were going to be a lot of people carrying semi-automatic weapons. And so for the first time in my career, I was advised to wear a bulletproof vest. And it's an odd experience before a scene putting on a bulletproof vest because you're facing up to the reality that you might get shot during the scene. And we were also advised by our security guard. He said, well, listen, the issue is the bulletproof vest is only going to do a certain amount.
Check your chest, yeah.
And he said, what? So he built an amplifier that would be, that was on stage, actually. You see it on stage. And he said, all right, this is going to be resistant to, you know, a lot of bullets, you know.
I'm going to build you a bulletproof amp.
Yeah, so it's basically like a tank. You know, he goes, if a number of people start shooting, jump behind that and we'll get you out of there.
Sasha, we came up with that idea. It wasn't really bulletproof. Just,
well, whatever. No. I was told.
It was like, just tell him there's a bulletproof amp. He'll believe it.
We were also, listen, we'd sent people to a similar rally at the same place the week beforehand. And we were told and warned that if people found out that you were not Republicans and that you were there on the other side, that they would get COVID positive people to spit on you. So the whole crew, and I must say the entire crew, are incredibly brave. You know, the field producers, who are predominantly women, are going out and really, you know, putting themselves at real risk. And actually after this rally, a number of their faces were put out and people were searching. I don't want to go into too much detail because of security concerns, but, you know, they were being tracked down by people, targeted. Yes. And we had to essentially move state in a rush and move people to safe houses, including myself. Or, you know, our first day back from filming was at another gun rights rally. It never ended up going on air, but it was in Richmond, Virginia. And I was wearing a fuck the NRA shirt accidentally as Borat. And I go, what the problem? Hey, fuck the NRA! Because I thought it was an anti-NRA.
Yeah.
It was a scene that we chopped out where Borat's looking for Tutar. She'd, in that version of the movie, she'd become anti-NRA. So to get in with her, he's wearing a fuck the NRA t-shirt. I was meant to be on the Antifa side, but I ended up on the NRA side. And there were thousands and thousands of people in battle gear with machine guns. And what was worse was the day before the rally, the FBI uncovered a plot by a number of members of the movement, which at the time was mushrooming on Facebook. And the plan was to carry out a mass shooting at this event.
Oh, my God.
So the FBI foiled a plot by a group to carry out a mass shooting at this event. And I remember the night before, Ann said, you should really give the crew a little pep talk. I said, listen, I'm not going to lie. I said, there is a certain amount of risk tomorrow. We're all aware of this FBI story. You know, there's a lot of people with machine guns and semi-automatics and accidents could happen. So I'm not going to ask you who's not going to come tomorrow. I'm going to ask you who is ready to come tomorrow. And the next day, a couple of crew members actually didn't turn up, which ended up pretty good. So we had to improvise really fast. We're like, we've got no sound. Bloody hell. So, but the sad thing was the thing never saw the light of day. So we put ourselves through that terrifying situation.
And that is, again, part of the process where you write this script and it's sort of a wish list and you know that perhaps 50% of it will be different by the time you get to the end, and you know you're going to spend days, weeks, possibly months.
Can I say what happens with Sasha as well is, like, at that the rally that ended up in the movie, whilst I was in an Airbnb about 25 miles away in a bulletproof vest, watching on a live link, that there was a point where I was watching it on the YouTube, on this link, and I could see in the crowd a guy heading towards the stage with a gun. And there was like, and we don't want to give away too much of the magic, but there's a way of people communicating, and the code word went out to get out of here. We got to abandon, abandon. But Sasha's in full, Sasha's being Borat, being, what's his, forget, Country oh, Steve. Right. Being Country Steve. So he's deep in some Daniel Day-Lewis place. I think shouting at the crowd and whatever, like, and we, and I knew, we could tell, I think Anne knew this as well, we had the scene, we knew we had the material for the scene, but Sasha's just in it, and I'm just thinking, there's a fucking guy heading for the stage with a gun, get off.
Sasha sang that song for about 20 minutes, it's like, are you sure? Until it got to a point where people realised this is not normal, wait a minute, and then rumour went round.
I think Sasha forgets self-preservation at that point, you know.
Well, I wanted to get the scene.
Yeah, we got the scene.
Oh, my goodness.
But there was, I must say, the crew and the writing team and everyone had the courage and the resilience to say, no, we're doing this, we've got to get it out for the election, we're doing it. And it was like fighting a war every day. And somehow with a lot of ingenuity, a lot of willpower and a good deal of luck, we managed to make this movie that we felt was impossible before coronavirus. So I don't know how it happened, but we did it.
Thank you for doing it, because it truly is a wonderful, wonderful film. I think we're out of time, and so we have to wrap up. Thank you for sitting and talking with me. Thank you for, again, making this film.
Thank you, Jerry. Lovely to speak to you.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's it for this episode. On Writing is a production of the Writers Guild of America East. Tech production and original music is by Stockboy Creative. You can learn more about the Writers Guild of America East online at wgaeast.org, and you can follow the Guild on social media at wgaeast. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and rate us. I'm Jerry Cole. Thank you for listening, and write on.
And now, the San Francisco Mime Troupe presents A Red Carol.
Marley was dead to begin with. That's how this story all the time starts, ain't it? Marley was dead. I mean, some guy you ain't never heard of and don't give a damn about was dead to begin with. Dead, and didn't nobody come to the funeral either. So that tells you two things. Marley wasn't well loved, and he was dead to begin with. Marley had been partners with a fella named Ebenezer Scrooge for I don't know how many years. And even Scrooge wasn't too cut up with Marley being dead. And Scrooge, he was a tight-fisted man. Squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. There's a lot of words to say one thing. Ebenezer Scrooge was a banker. Yeah, I bet you didn't know that. How many times you hear this story, never picked up on that? See, Scrooge and Marley ran a counting house, and that's what they called banks in them days. And after Marley died, Scrooge was too cheap to even paint out Marley's name over the door 7 years later. So there still was, over the door of their counting house / bank, Scrooge and Marley.
Bob, are you going to tell the story or not?
I'm telling it. But when I say Scrooge, y'all just think Ebenezer Wells Fargo Goldman Sachs Bank of America Scrooge.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time. Of all good days of the year, on Christmas Eve, old Ebenezer Scrooge sat busy at work. Grim place, if ever there was one. The door to his office was all the time open so he could keep an eye on the guy who kept the books for him, name of Bob Cratchit. And while outside, folks were singing Christmas carols, the place where Cratchit sat was cold and hard as a prison cell.
Hail you and where you come from, hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Oh,
I'm come from the land of Egypt. Hallelujah.
Oh, I'm come from the land of Egypt. Hallelujah. 19, 20, 21, 22. Hallelujah. 23, 26, 29, 9 carry 2. Hallelujah.
Oh, I'm bound for the land of glory. Hallelujah. Oh, I'm bound for the
Cratchit. Oh, sorry, Mr. Scrooge.
Hallelujah.
It's very cold, Mr. Scrooge. Perhaps I could turn the heat up a little.
Turn up the heat? Well, just because you're a liberal at home with your own money, burning it, wasting it.
I don't have money to waste, sir.
Oh, so it's just my money you want to waste.
Mr. Scrooge.
Not yours. But mine.
You misunderstand.
Burning through it.
I would never.
My heat? My money?
No!
No? You don't want to? To turn up the heat?
No, sir.
Not cold anymore, are you?
No, sir.
Then back finishing the notices of foreclosure. Have you done the paperwork on Mrs. Clyburn?
Just getting to it, Mr. Scrooge.
Just getting to it.
I heard she's been very sick, Mr. Scrooge.
She wasn't too sick to borrow the money. Sickness shouldn't delay her paying it back. Or perhaps she can get well while in debtor's prison.
A Merry Christmas, Uncle!
Bah, humbug.
Now that's a word people don't use no more. Humbug. But any of y'all know what humbug is? Man, you hear it every Christmas on commercials, TV specials, don't know what the hell it means. A humbug is a hustle, a racket. What we nowadays call con game, in them days, they called a
humbug.
Christmas a humbug? You don't mean that.
Oh, nephew Fred. Come to borrow money, I suppose.
I want nothing from you.
Bah.
And I've never asked you for anything.
Bah.
I just came to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas? What reason have you to be merry? You're poor enough.
What reason have you to be miserable? You're rich enough. Don't be angry, Uncle.
What else can I be when I live in such a world of fools as this? What's Christmas time but a time for finding yourself a year older, but not one hour richer? If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be cooked with his own goose, then buried with a stake of holly through his heart.
Uncle!
Not like you've ever profited from it.
There are many things that have done me good that didn't profit me a penny. Christmas among them. I have always thought of Christmas as a good time. A pleasant time, a kind, forgiving, charitable time. The only time in the long calendar of the year when men and women agree to open their shut-up hearts and see each other, no matter how poor or different, as fellow passengers through life, and not some other race of creatures bound on other journeys. And so, Uncle, though it has never put any money in my pocket, I believe that it has done me good. And will do me good.
Yeah, nice little speech. Maybe you should go into politics. Get some of your filthy fellow creatures to vote for you.
Don't be like that. Have dinner with us tomorrow.
I'll see you in hell first.
Uncle, I came here because it's Christmas and I intend on keeping my Christmas spirit. So, Merry Christmas.
Humbug.
And a Happy New Year!
Humbug! Humbug!
Merry Christmas to you, Bob.
And a merry... Good night.
A wife and a family to feed. And there he sits, talking about a Merry Christmas.
Scrooge and Marley's, I believe.
And are you Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?
Mr. Marley's dead. He died 7 years ago. 7 years ago this very night.
Mr. Scrooge, in this charitable season, it's only fitting that those of us who are well off try to raise a fund to help the less fortunate.
Less fortunate?
Oh, you may not believe it, but in a country rich as ours, millions are still in need of basic necessities. Despite our wealth, millions are hungry and homeless.
Are there no prisons?
Well, yes, there are plenty of prisons.
The workhouses, they're still in operation. The poor law, still in effect.
I wish I could say they were not.
The treadmill, still turning?
You don't know what those are, do you? The treadmill, the poor laws. Every Christmas you hear some actor say it.
The poor laws were rules against giving money or food to the poor and hungry. Laws that said they couldn't get any relief except inside a workhouse.
Workhouses were prisons the government built for those who couldn't find work. who couldn't pay their debts.
A prison for being poor. And where the rules also said, keep us hungry and cold, so the poor wouldn't get dependent on the generosity of the workhouse. The starvation, the beatings, and worse, all for our own good, they said.
And since they had free labor, why not put it to use?
The treadmill.
The treadmill was a giant wheel made of wood and iron used to grind corn and wheat.
And to make money for whoever managed the workhouse.
The poor were chained to the outside of the wheel, and all day they climbed until their feet and hands are bloody, until their bones were cracking and their throats were raw with screaming.
Till we don't care if we get crushed, till we ain't even human no more. All for our own good.
I'm glad to hear of it. I was afraid from what you said that something had stopped them in their useful course.
Mr. Scrooge, Christmas is when our brothers and sisters feel most destitute.
Brothers and sisters.
So we're asking those who can afford it, men of means like yourself, to help us raise money for the poor and homeless.
What shall I put you down for?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous.
I wish to be left alone. My taxes support the organizations I mentioned. Let those who are too lazy to work go there.
Many can't go there, sir.
Many would rather die.
If they would rather die, then they should do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, how do I even know where this money goes?
The money goes to the poor.
So you just skim a little off the top.
Mr. Scrooge.
It's a humbug, isn't it? Helping the poor, more like helping yourself.
Mr. Scrooge.
That's your business, not mine. It's enough for a man to understand his own business and not to interfere with other people's. Mine occupies me constantly. Good evening.
But...
I said good evening.
It's getting a little dark. It's hard to see the figures.
Eager to get home, Wife and kiddies?
Oh, yes, sir.
Don't see the profit in them myself. I suppose you'll want the entire day off tomorrow.
If it's all right. It is Christmas Day.
It's not all right, and it's not fair. If I was to cut the day out of your paycheck, you wouldn't think that all right, would you? But it's all right for me to pay a day's wages for no work.
It's only once a year, sir.
A fine excuse for picking a man's pocket every December 25th. Well, see that you're here that much earlier the day after.
So Scrooge left the counting house slash bank and started home. It was a cold night, biting, but Scrooge didn't notice. No fire could warm Scrooge, nor winter weather chill him. No wind blew more bitter than Scrooge, 'cause he was a banker.
Get on with it!
I am! Anyway, in a doorway on the cold street, a ragged child was singing.
Oh, Christmas tree, you stand serene. In winter shroud, you're evergreen. The worker's flag, though his deepest dread, it shrouded oft our martyr dead.
Humbug!
Every year, people think that's funny. Scrooge barks at some kid who's singing for pennies, and the kid runs away. Ha ha. But for the hungry children walking around in the snow, caroling wasn't for fun. Time was big city like this, half the funerals were for kids under 10. Families forced off farms and into cities, poverty split some kids on their own. They was ignorant and starving and didn't know what else to do. And they died, cold and alone in doorways and alleys, unloved and unremembered. Singing carols, hoping for a few pennies, wasn't about keeping the Christmas spirit. It was about keeping from dying. That's who Scrooge just chased away. Scrooge lived in a big old house, used to belong to Marley, who was dead to begin with. The path to the door was so dark, Scrooge had to feel his way along the wall. But darkness was cheap, so he liked it. But this night, after he found his way through the dark, after he found his key in his pocket, and just as he was putting it in the lock, Scrooge looked up at the big door knocker, as that's the thing they had before doorbells. Now, normally, it was just a big brass ring. But as Scrooge looked at it, it changed. Changed into the face of... Jacob Marley! Jacob! Humbug! The house was cold and empty. A wreck of a building. Musty and dusty, and nobody lived in it but Scrooge. A bunch of families could have fit in there, but now he's in there by himself. He made his way upstairs to his bed. The same bed Jacob Marley had died in 7 years ago. And got ready to sleep. But then... What is that? Who's there? That's better. It's a humbug, I say. A hum. Who are you?
Ask me rather who I was.
All right. Who are you?
In life, I was your partner. Jacob Marley.
But you're dead to begin with. What do you want of me? This must be a dream. A dream.
You don't believe in me.
I don't. Humbug!
Man of the worldly mind, do you believe in me or no?
I do. I must. But tell me, Jacob, why? Why do you come to me?
It is required of everyone during their lives to walk among their fellow men and women, to share their lives. And if one doesn't do so in their life, their spirit is condemned to do so in death. And witness those lives they might have shared on earth and turn to happiness.
But Jacob, why are you chained? Marley's chains. You ever notice how the people who normally tell this story don't ever tell you what's at the other end of those chains?
I wear the chains I forged in life.
Every Christmas, Marley is clanking around. But they don't want to tell you what he's dragging.
I made it link by link, and yard by yard.
Cash boxes. That's what he's chained to. What he's all the time dragging through the story, through eternity. Bank books made of lead, wallets of iron. Because he was a banker, too.
And your chain was as long as this when I died, Ebenezer. And you've been adding to it ever since.
But you were always a good man of business, Jacob.
Business?
Ebenezer.
Mankind was my business. Charity, mercy, kindness. They were all my business. The dealings of our trade were but a drop of water in the vast ocean of my business.
Jacob.
My time grows short. Hear me, Ebenezer. You have yet a chance of escaping my fate.
You were always a good friend to me, Jacob.
You will be haunted by three spirits.
Is that the chance you spoke of?
It is. It is.
Then I'd rather not.
Without their visits, you cannot hope to avoid my fate. Expect the first tomorrow night when the bell tolls one. Expect the second the next night at the hour of doom. And the third the next night when the last stroke of three has ceased to vibrate.
Could I take them all at once and then have it over?
Come here, Ebenezer. Come and look.
No. Jacob, don't open the window! The cold!
Look!
And Scrooge saw, down in the alley behind his big empty house, a woman huddled in the snow, singing a lullaby to the baby wrapped in rags she held to her breast.
Jacob, I can see ghosts, spirits all around the woman. Who are they? They seem tortured, and they're chained like you and... Wait, I recognize that's Moynihan, and Schraff, and old Jamie Dimon. I know these men.
You should. In life, they were bankers and businessmen like you. But now, they're tormented because they are unable to help this one poor woman and child to finally do some good. But they have lost the power to help anyone to do any good forever.
Red Carol is based on A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens and was written and directed by Michael Gene Sullivan, featuring traditional music with additional lyrics and arrangement by Daniel Savio, strings by Patrick Byers, percussion by David Rokish, keyboards by Daniel Savio with additional mandolin by Amos Glick, audio engineering and sound design by Taylor Gonzalez. A Red Carol featured Mike McShane as Scrooge, Michael Gene Sullivan as Bob Cratchit, Felina Brown as Mrs. Cratchit, Andre Amorodico as Fred, Lisa Hori Garcia as Belle, Amos Glick as Fezziwig, Gerian Monroe as the ghost of Jacob Marley, Keiko Shimasato Carrero as the ghost of Christmas Past, Wilma Bonet as the ghost of Christmas Present, and Milo Carter Daniels as Tiny Tim.
The little elfin leader read a list of their demands. He said, "We want brand new outfits and new work gloves for our hands. A little elf gymnasium where we can have some fun. And three paid weeks in Florida when Christmas time is done." Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly. And Billy almost didn't get...
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from nearly 80 Labor Radio shows and podcasts. The Labor Radio Podcast Network shows focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our music this week included The Year the Elves Went Out on Strike by Barry Rabin, Rudolph the Union Reindeer, and Organize, 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 both sung by Ariana Eagle Blockman, a member of IBEW Local 124. Thanks to Judy Ansell and the Heartland Labor Forum for sharing these. The Heartland Labor Forum airs weekly on KKFI in Kansas City. You can catch their latest show, The Truth About Santa's Workshop, available now at heartlandlaborforum.org. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Evan Papp, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net. Find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Also, check out our new weekly live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock, urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show. See you next week.